Hello, this is Paul Johnson with The Optimistic American. We have a brilliant show today with Professor James Robinson, who wrote literally two groundbreaking books. One is called Why Nations Fail, and the other is The Narrow Corridor. Now, these books are amazing books that tell you about why nations actually become successful and why others fail. They're two very, very internationally popular books, and these professors have worked in economies all around the world trying to understand them, to understand the differences that they make. Now, when I watch our show, I can go on YouTube at any time and just look at some of the posts. Some of the posts that you will find are unbelievably negative. I mean, they just think that the United States is crumbling, that we're going to fall apart, that it's not going to work. Well, one, that's not true. But this book puts scientific data behind that, and it explains to you why that's not so. It's incredibly optimistic about the United States and Western democracy and why it is that our economies are so successful. And the single focus of that, I will just give you a hint to, is the individual. There's nothing that our government ever did better, and we've done some wonderful things in government, including building bridges and dams and freeways, but it was prioritizing the individual over itself that made our government special. Now, we hope if you support this work that you'll subscribe. If you do subscribe, I promise you we won't send you a bunch of crazy emails. We won't give your names to other people, but it definitely helps us continue our work, and it's at no cost to you. Now, here we go with our show. Welcome, Professor James Robinson. How are you doing today?
Very good, thank you.
Well, thank you very much for coming on our show. And here's the first question that I'd like to ask you. I really do think that both of your books, the Why Nations Fail and The Narrow Corridor, are probably two of the most important books that anyone needs to read from an economic standpoint as well as a political standpoint. Now, I spent a long time in politics. I was mayor of Phoenix, 20 years ago or something like that. And I've been listening to the doomsayers for a long time. I've never seen it as intense as it is today. On our comment posts on YouTube, you'll just see these people who have these incredible versions of how bad it is in the United States and how the country is going to fail. I know that you studied in your book, Why Nations Fail, you were also studying Why Nations Prosper. But, I remember the chapter on Venice and listening to some of the other portions of the book as well. In your study of Why Nations Fail, where do you think the United States is today?
Well, I think the United States, the institutions in the United States are being challenged. But I think one of the things that we point out in the book is that that's not the first time. The institutions in the United States have been challenged lots of times. We talk about the robber barons in the 19th century, or we talk about Roosevelt's plan to pack the Supreme Court in the 1930s. So I think there's nothing new about that. We make this distinction between societies with extractive and inclusive institutions. And in a society with inclusive institutions, there's always incentives to set that into reverse. You mentioned Venice. That's kind of one of the most interesting examples. That Venice might have been the most prosperous place in the world in the late Middle Ages, and everything went into reverse, and all the institutions that had generated that prosperity were dismantled, basically. So it can happen. It can happen. But I think that's rather unlikely in the United States. I think what many things have been surprising in this country in the last 5 or 6 years. But I think one thing you've seen is that a lot of people are willing to stand up and fight for the institutions. They believe in the institutions, even at the expense of their own careers and jobs. They're willing to kind of put their money where their mouth is. And that's what makes this country work so well. That's not true in Argentina. That's not true in Colombia. It's not true in many parts of the world. So I'm still optimistic that, yeah, there's challenges, but also sometimes challenges are good. There's a lot of discontent in this country. I think like my main reading of the whole January 6th event, after President Trump lost the election, was gosh, you know, we should understand better why all these people are so unhappy and why there's so much discontent in this country. So it's a wake-up call. One reading of it is it's a wake-up call to understand these people better and understand why they're so unhappy. You know, so I think that's my basic take on it.
Okay, so extractive and inclusive institutions as well as political systems. That it's a very simple concept, but it definitely needs some explaining. So if you would you just give my, you don't even need to make it brief. Help us have an understanding of what exactly that meant and why it's important.
Yeah, so you know, Why Nations Fail is trying to explain the enormous differences in prosperity you see in the world. You know, I just came back on Saturday from 3 weeks doing research in Nigeria, you know, and you know, levels of prosperity in Nigeria are, you know, perhaps, I don't know, 5% of what they are in the United States, or 2%, or, you know, it depends how you adjust for living standards. But the fraction, you know, the living standards of people in Nigeria is just awful. You know, the roads are terrible. There's no electricity. You know, there's no running water in large parts of the country. Basic kind of services and amenities that we all take for granted don't exist. You know, so how is it that in the world, the modern world today, you have societies that just differ so much in terms of living standards, prosperity, with all the consequences that has for people's health and longevity and standards of living? So that's what the book is about, trying to understand, you know, both why that is today, but also historically, you know, because the United States didn't become the United States 10 years ago and Nigeria didn't become Nigeria 10 years ago either. That's a long historical process. So that's also part of the book. And what we argue is basically that's to do with the incentives in society, the rules that govern people's incentives and opportunities, that the difference between the United States and a place like Nigeria is in the United States, you have what we call inclusive institutions, which are rules in the economy, first of all, that create broad-based incentives and opportunities. And Nigeria doesn't have that. Nigeria has the opposite, what we call extractive institutions. Extractive institutions, they may concentrate opportunities in the hands of some people. You know, the richest man in Africa happens to be Nigerian, but most people don't get access to opportunities and don't have incentives at all. So inclusive and extractive, you know, and why, you know, let me dwell then, since you encouraged me, on why inclusive. You know, why do we use, I think that word inclusive is very important. You know, we've known, you know, for many decades, since the work of Robert Solow in the 1950s in economics, that what really drives prosperity, what drives economic growth, is innovation, you know, new technologies, new ideas, entrepreneurship, creativity, you know, all the things that make human society so exciting. And where does that come from? That comes from people's ideas, people's, you know, projects, people's aspirations, people's drive. You know, that's where innovation comes from. You know, if you look at the industrial, you know, the whole start of all this prosperity in the modern world, which starts in the 18th century in England, you know, it's about innovation. It's the steam engine, it's steam trains, it's the factory system, it's the mechanization of cotton spinning, cotton, you know, it's all new ideas, new innovation, raising productivity. Who came up with those ideas? You know, who invented the steam engine or the railway or tarmac or, you know, whatever it was? You know, what you see is that those people come from everywhere in society. You know, you don't know who they are. You know, the government doesn't know who they are. I don't know who they are, you know. So what you need to be successful economically is a system of rules, a system of, you know, what we call institutions, what social scientists called institutions, that create very broad-based incentives and opportunities. So all that talent can get to the top. So you can get a loan, so you can start a business, so you can have secure property rights, so you can invest and enjoy the fruits of your efforts and your investment. So that's what, you know, and all that talent gets to the top. You know, I always think, I worked a lot in Africa, you know, for the last 25 years. And, you know, one sentence version of like why Africa is like it is like wasted talent. No, it's like a two word version. It's like there's so much talent, and it's just, it's trapped. You know, it can't flourish the way it can flourish in the United States. So that's this idea of inclusion. We need to include everybody to give all these opportunities and for everybody and incentives for everybody. And that's what you don't have in a place like Nigeria. Some people have great incentives if you have the right connections or whatever, but most people, they don't. So inclusive and extractive. So that's, I'm kind of talking about the economic sphere, talking about the Industrial Revolution. You know, if you look at the 19th century, you know, in the US, when the US becomes the world economic leader, what's driving that? Innovation, entrepreneurship, you know, who's doing it? Individuals are, you know, people from all over the social spectrum. There's beautiful research on this by economic historians, like looking at, you know, where do innovators come from? Where do they come from? Who are they? Like, well, who were their parents? You know, just sort of looking at the sociology of innovation. And what you see is people come from everywhere, all over the social spectrum. And I, you know, so if you want, you've got to tap into that. And that's what inclusion is about. But you know, in some sense, we're talking about economic institutions. So there's two layers of this. You know, there's inclusive economic institutions. There's extractive economic institutions. You know, at the end of the first chapter, we kind of illustrate this with not two countries, but two people, which is Bill Gates and Carlos Slim, you know, who were the two richest men in the world at the time we wrote the book, you know, and both incredibly talented, you know, driven entrepreneurs. But it's not how rich they are, but how they made their money that's so interesting. You know, Bill Gates, you know, for all the criticisms you could make about Microsoft, made his money by innovating in the computer industry. He sucked enormous amounts of talent and energy into that industry. Carlos Slim made his money by getting his friends in the government to privatize a telecom monopoly to him. You know, Bill Gates, you know, actually, for all his wealth, generated far more wealth than he himself benefited from. There's huge externalities in that process. The opposite is true with Carlos Slim. You know, a very conservative calculation made by the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development calculated that national income in Mexico was over, you know, the fall in national income associated with Carlos Slim's monopoly was over double his personal fortune. So it's not just about taking money from the average Mexican and giving it to Carlos Slim. Everybody's poorer at the same time. So that's what extractive institutions do. You know, that's a kind of microcosm of, you know, why there's incentives to create extractive institutions, but why they impoverish society. But then, you know, the next layer of this is to say, okay, fine. So some countries have inclusive economic institutions and they innovate and there's entrepreneurship and they prosper, and other societies have extractive economic institutions. Like, where does that come from? You know, fundamentally, like, why does a society like that get set up? And that's to do with politics. You know, when I give a talk about why nations fail, I put up the slide of Bill Gates, you know, being dragged in front of the antitrust authorities in Washington. You know, Microsoft was found guilty of violating the Sherman Act, you know, for monopolistic practices. That scene is just unimaginable in Mexico or Nigeria or whatever. You know, there's just no way that that's ever going to happen because these people are too politically connected for anything like that to occur. So again, you know, we could argue about, you know, the ruling, the Microsoft ruling, and whether it was good or whether they should have gone further or whatever, you know. But I think what you see in the United States is, you know, what fundamentally protects that inclusive economy is an inclusive political system. So we say, you know, there's two layers. There's the economic layer, there's inclusive and extractive economic institutions, but lying behind that is politics in some sense. It's politics that generates an extractive economy, and it's politics that generates an inclusive economy. You know, why did Venice, you know, you mentioned Venice, why did Venice go into reverse? Why did the inclusive economic institutions become dismantled and turned extractive? Because the politics made a transition from inclusive to extractive. Okay, and what do we mean by inclusive political institutions? Well, broad-based political rights, accountability, you know, democracy, but also a state which is powerful enough to implement the law and the rules. So there's two dimensions to this. You need accountability, but you need the state capacity. You know, it's not just a matter of the laws. In Mexico, they have great antitrust laws. You know, I know who wrote them, but the state can't enforce them against Carlos Slim. Impossible. So you need these two elements. And I think if you look at most poor countries, you know, like Nigeria, for example, you know, you see massive failure in one or both of those dimensions, you know, either in the extent of accountability or kind of political participation, or what we call a broad distribution of political power, or in the capacity of the state. You know, if you drive from Port Harcourt, you know, I just drove from Port Harcourt to Owerri, which is about 100 kilometers in eastern Nigeria. I was stopped 25 times by police and military who want bribes and kind of shaking down. You know, it's just like such a palaver, my mother would have said. You know, it's like you have to negotiate. It's like it's 100 kilometers, but it could take you all day because you have to negotiate with all these robbers, basically. And they're all working for the government, you know. So that, you know, there's just huge challenges with the way the state works. You know, if you go into a village in Nigeria, and nobody expects the government to do anything. You know, they you have to provide everything yourself: water, schools, everything, security, order. The government doesn't do a thing. So that's a fundamental problem for just even if you wanted to create inclusive institutions, or even if voters and citizens wanted to create them in Nigeria, the state doesn't have the organizational capacity to actually do it. Am I talking too long?
No, not at all. So in the United States, it seems to me that we started with this beautiful idea that said that we wanted to release the genius of the individual. And we did that through the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, property rights that were all included within it. I know that you've given both talks, and I've read some on what you've spoken about on the patent industry. And maybe if you could talk a little bit about that, because I think that really points out how almost from the beginnings of our country, we put a focus on innovation.
Yeah, I think that's a beautiful example of an inclusive institution. You know, the patent, you know, this whole issue of patents was very, you go back to the 17th century in England, the 1620s, there was contests over patents and kind of property rights for innovators. And at the time of the Constitution, as you say, that it was written in the Constitution, and the first patent board met in 1790. And it was so important that Thomas Jefferson was on it, you know, like someone as important as Jefferson was on the patent board deciding, you know, whose innovations should warranted a patent. So I think that shows like how important people understood this. And what's interesting about the patent, and actually those examples, you know, the examples I gave you of you know, who the social background of innovators in the 19th century US or 20th century, where does that information come from? It actually comes from patent data. So patents, you know, patents, if somebody files a patent, you know, then you can trace who these people are, and historians have investigated these people's background. So I think what's interesting about the patent is, you know, anyone could take out a patent, you know, and everyone paid the same price for the patent, and the state protected your intellectual property rights. You know, that creates, you know, innovations. I was mentioning, you know, with Bill Gates, that innovations, you know, this is something that, you know, Paul Romer emphasized a lot, you know, who got the Nobel Prize for his work on kind of innovation and technical change, that, you know, ideas are just what economists call non-rivalrous things. You know, I can have an idea, and then you can have it, and you can use it. And that it doesn't cost me anything. It doesn't extinguish anything, or it's not like a cup of coffee. If I drink the cup of coffee, you can't drink the cup of coffee. But ideas aren't like that. So that's a problem for creating innovation, because it means that if I invent something, you can copy it without making effort. You know, so patent plays a very important role in protecting my intellectual property rights and creating much better incentives, kind of aligning my personal incentives with the social incentives for the incentives for society in such a way as to encourage innovation. So I think the patent system was absolutely crucial in terms of stimulating innovation. And it still happens today. You know, like most of these people, Steve Jobs, everybody, you know, Bill Gates, they have lots of patents. It's more complicated now because, you know, companies have patents, and it's more sort of institutionalized than it was in the 19th century. It's kind of cleaner. You know, we can look at Edison, you know, and Edison had over 1,000 patents. I think he was probably the world record patent holder, but everybody's still taking out patents. And I think, you know, it's very well established in economics, the connection between patenting and innovation. And as you know, it's a brilliant example of an inclusive economic institution.
Yeah, I think that Romer's book, wasn't it, The Wealth and Knowledge of Nations? I think that was the name of his book. Taken from Adam, a big part from Adam Smith, which, by the way, I read a lot of Adam Smith and a lot of what you all have written. But But one of the things that I find interesting, you know, I love Ayn Rand, especially Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged and a series of books that she's written. But she was very anti-trust. She thought that somehow or another that was taking something from the individual. Our antitrust laws, there's a great book called, I think, Titan about Rockefeller, where it talks about the antitrust laws coming into place. Your work actually says that it was very, it seems to say that it was valuable because not only can government become extractive, but when corporations can begin to dominate or monopolize an industry like Carlos Slim has, they also can be extractive.
I think that's right. You know, I think that's what the facts are. I think, you know, if you study developing countries, you know, like Colombia, you know, I work a lot in Colombia. I teach in Bogota every summer. You know, in Colombia, everything, all the strings are being pulled, you know, by these, they're not as famous as Carlos Slim or other people, but they manage the political system, the economy. There's enormous barriers to entry, you know, like they create enormous barriers to entry, barriers to innovation. I think the market, you know, markets are a great thing, but sometimes markets don't work, you know, because people don't want them to work and because they can block competition and they can block innovation because that's good for them. And I think, you know, if people have the power, they can disrupt markets. So I think you do need antitrust to try. I think the data suggests, or the evidence, historical evidence suggests, that you do need antitrust to stop individuals dominating markets, you know, to too large an extent, because that does block innovation and it does impede inclusion.
Yeah, I remember one of the stories that I enjoyed listening to was the idea that we used to have three steel companies, U.S. Steel, Bethlehem Steel, I forget what the third one was, but somebody started making rebar and small smelters, and the big steel companies felt like wasn't such a big deal because it was a low margin product and they gave it up. But over time, as those small smelters kept eating into them, eventually it bankrupted the three big companies and they had to reorganize. But it was a creative destruction that was taking place and remaking the steel industry, making it more affordable, making our products cheaper. The analysis was done with China, where they had a large steel smelter company and someone went to go into business to make rebar and they put them in prison for the rest of their life. That becomes a very extractive policy. I'd love to know, China has certainly an extractive political sphere, but they seem to have a more inclusive economic one. I'd love to know your take on China, not only what you've seen that's been happening, but where you think they are.
Yeah, I think, you know, China partly fits what I'm talking about fantastically. You know, if you think about and go back to the 1970s, China was very poor, technologically backward. It had extremely extractive kind of socialist economic institutions. And what drove Chinese economic growth was exactly dismantling all of that. You know, like, where did Deng Xiaoping start? In agriculture. You know, he basically abolished collectivized agriculture. He introduced this thing called the household responsibility system. What did that do? It allowed people to make decisions, basically what to plant, what to farm. He deregulated prices. He gave people incentives, you know, and what happened is just productivity went through the roof, you know, and then that moved into the industrial sector into the 1980s. And, you know, so what's funny about China is that, you know, people sort of talk about the genius of the Communist Party, but actually the real story is the Communist Party just stopped trying to micromanage and got off everyone's backs and allowed them to do, you know, what they do, allow Jack Ma to do what he's good at. And that's why the economy boomed, you know, so not through the genius of the Communist Party. And I guess what, you know, what we say is, so that fits perfectly, like all the economic growth is driven by this movement towards much more inclusive economic institutions. But the political institutions have stayed extractive, you know, there's no accountability, there's no, you know, transparency, there's no, you know, rule of law basically in China. So what do I say about that? I say it's not sustainable. You know, what we show in the book is there's many examples in world history of kind of unsustainable periods of economic growth. You know, like a famous example would be Argentina. You know, for 50 years up until the 1920s, Argentina grew very rapidly. It was one of the richest countries in the world, probably one of the 10 richest countries in the world in 1920. But It never had inclusive political institutions. It was this combination of extractive political institutions with inclusive economic institutions. It generated growth, but it can only do that in a transitory way. Another fantastic example would be the Soviet Union. You know, between the mid-1920s, for 50 years, the Soviet Union was one of the most rapidly growing economies in the world. You know, when I was an undergraduate, we learned all this stuff about how great central planning was. And young people laugh when you tell them that nowadays, you know, but it's true. I even went and checked, you know, we have this story in Why Nations Fail. I went and checked. I went and got my old textbook on comparative economic systems that I read at the library at the LSE, you know, and it's there. It says, like, if you want to have a successful, you know, economic development, you need to have central planning and a Soviet-style economy. You know, it's kind of laughable in retrospect, but I think that shows you how easily you can be fooled, you know, by 20 or 30 years economic growth. I mean, it was in every single textbook. If you, you know, if you go back and read Paul Samuelson's, you know, the one of the greatest economists of all time, Paul Samuelson's textbook, again, you know, which I read as an undergraduate, he had this graph of like the Soviet Union overtaking the US, you know, and then if you look at the 1960s version of his book, it's overtaking in the 1970s, and then they kind of delay it, and it's overtaking in the 1980s, and then delay it, it's overtaking in the 1990s, and then the graph disappears. And then it comes back, except instead of the Soviet Union overtaking the United States, it's China, you know. I think same author, same idea, different country. I think this is a good reason for studying history. So I think, even though when I stand up and talk about this, people say, oh no, come on, can't be, you know, and China has managed to do lots of things that the Soviet Union never did. You know, China's economy is based on exporting, so that forces you to be much more efficient to produce, you know, competitively what stuff, what people want, you know, so that there's all sorts of benefits that from the Chinese model compared to the Soviet model, you know, but I think my view is that you can't have an inclusive economy at the whim of a dictatorship. You know, look at Jack Ma, you know, look at anyone who starts complaining, they disappear for 3 months and nobody knows where they are. You know, the tennis player, that lady tennis player, you know, you can't have an innovative society in such a totalitarian state. You know, it's like Russia, you know, the head of Lukoil criticizes Putin and he falls out the window of the hospital. You know, this is just totalitarian. You can't have an innovative society like that in a sustained way. You know,
one of my favorite economists, I was listening to them once and they were speaking to a Chinese economist and they said, well, what I love about the Chinese economy is how fast we're growing and how much productivity is happening here and how we're going to overcome the rest of the world because of it. He goes, oh, okay. He says, well, what's your favorite part about the United States? He goes, oh, when it's going bad in the United States, you're allowed to say so, right? And it's there's a new good book called The Quiet Americans about the intelligence agency during the 1940s to 1950s working on Moscow. What's amazing when you're reading the book is to recognize how little information we really had from the inside, how we really didn't understand, how when you have a controlled economy, the one thing that you do have the power to do is to make certain that the information that's being dispersed in and out of your country is dramatically controlled. That's something we don't have the ability to do in the U.S. It's dramatically distributed here, which, of course, empowers individuals as part of the process.
Yeah, well, I think that's a good thing. I mean, I think, you know, one fact I find very telling is all of these Chinese entrepreneurs and business people, they just want to get out of the country. They want to get their family out of the country. They want to buy property out of the country. They all want, you know, foreign passports, Canadian passports, Australian passports, you know, whatever it is. Like, I think that tells you a lot about people's expectations about what's going to happen in the future in China. Yeah, of course you can grow fast. You have very low wages. You know, you're just basically benefiting from all these innovations and ideas and technologies that were invented somewhere else and you're just adopting them. You know, but that, you know, yeah.
Yeah, Larry Summers was on and he said, look, if I were to summarize what I've seen, he said the issue is there are two factors to watch constantly. Where does capital want to go and where does labor want to go? And he said they want to come into the United States and they're trying to get out of China. All right. So on the narrow corridor, I really think with all of this authoritarian populism that's happening today, especially as that can begin to become a threat not only to Western democracy, but to liberty and to the individual itself. The narrow corridor really laid out a beautiful concept that perpetuated what you had done in the work with Why Nations Fail. But would you describe that narrow corridor, the box, how you have very strong states and how you can have very strong societies and how they conflict with one another and what that corridor actually means?
Yeah, I think in Why Nations Fail, we did a good job of sort of trying to give people a simple way of thinking about these differences. But I mentioned, you know, that this is also it's a sort of historical process, how Nigeria becomes Nigeria and the United States becomes the United States. And we do talk about that, but we felt we hadn't done a good job of helping people understand that process, you know, this the emergence of inclusive societies and how things can go wrong and how you can become sort of extractive. So I think the narrow corridor is much more focused on the process and how, you know, how difficult it is to get the process going. And also, you know, how you can fall out of this corridor. You know, so the idea, you know, so it's as you said, it's the idea is it's there's a balance between there's a contest in some sense between the state and the society. You know, people are trying to control the government and they're trying to get it to do what they want. But the government is trying to control people also. You know, that's what happens in China. And, you know, that's what happened. That it happens here, too. You know, so many people are concerned about that. So there's this contest. And, you know, what you see in many parts of the world, and this is a way we use of sort of classifying societies, is, you know, some parts of the world like China, what you have is, you know, the state dominates society, but society can also dominate the state. You know, that's true in large parts of Africa, for example, or South Asia. You know, the society is very powerful relative to the state, or you could say historically in much of the world also, you know, before modern state institutions were developed. So the difficult thing in developing inclusive institutions is you have to get this balance between state and society right. And once you get it right, then there's all sorts of mechanisms that can kind of lead that thing, that competition. That competition is very creative. You know, in the process, you, as we say, you know, states become stronger, society becomes stronger, more cohesive, you know, kind of more coherent identities, better able to act collectively. The state becomes stronger. So that competition is very, it's very creative and it's very powerful, but it can also become sort of unstable, you know. So we try to tell, you know, I'm not sure I understand very well all of this autocratic populism we have in the world today. It's very, you know, Hungary, the Philippines, Brazil. It's a very complicated, you know, Russia. It's a very complicated phenomena and it's happening in different contexts, you know, that it's, you know, it's a sort of global thing. So you look for global processes, you know, globalization or rising inequality, or I don't know, but it's a very complicated thing. But we try to think about, you know, how that could happen. You know, how could, you know, we talk about it, we have one chapter which we call Red Queen Out of Control. We describe this kind of competition between state and society as the Red Queen effect. And then we think about how you can move out of the corridor, you know, like the example we use, the sort of leading example we use would be Nazi Germany. You know, in some sense, Germany kind of historically was a society like Britain or Western Europe that sort of had this dynamic developing more inclusive institutions, stronger society, stronger state. But then it crashed out of the corridor in the 1930s with the Nazi state. In many ways that was popular. You know, there were millions of Germans voted for Hitler. He didn't have a majority, of course, and he had to fix everything to take power. But a kind of unbelievable number of Germans supported Hitler and the Nazis, the construction of the Nazi state. So we were trying to sort of think through what mechanisms could lead to such an outcome. I don't know if that's, you know, we try to talk about that in the context today. That's just really sort of putting ideas out there. I'm not sure social scientists really understand this very well. I don't know what your view about this is, but it's a very complicated phenomenon.
Definitely. I tend to buy into what Eric Hoffer told us maybe 60 years ago, 70 years ago. He said that all revolutions that happen, none happen from people who have a lot and want more. None happen from people who have nothing and want something. They all happen from a group of people who had something and lose a piece of it. I think in the United States, you know, you can see, as an example, polling of optimism. Minority groups are much more optimistic than middle-class white America, especially the lower two quartiles of white America. And the reason for that tends to be that even though the lower two quartiles are actually still doing better than their minority counterparts in the United States, the minority groups are seeing growth, and the Anglo community is feeling like they've lost something. Now, it doesn't take, by the way, I think those losses aren't just economic. I think some of them, through political correctness, are social losses that they're feeling, pressure, constraint, the creating invisibility. And it's inevitable when you turn someone invisible that someone will come along and see them. And when he recognizes them and speaks their language, that they'll follow him regardless of whether he lies or cheats or steals or does anything else, because now they feel seen. Well, to me, the challenge, it begins with understanding how well we have it, all right, putting things in perspective. And unfortunately, I think people are being bombarded by negative messages from the nightly news, from political parties, from political candidates. They're getting so much negativity that they lose the ability to really see perspective. You've been all over the world. I mean, I love the fact that you go into, I know that you won't work as a consultant because you said that was not a positive experience for you, but that you go around and you help advise and give people information about what works. I also love your historical perspective. One of the things I think, I can't remember if it was the last book or the first book, but you talked about in the 250 years, the changes that have happened between economies and how the rule of law, when it came about, actually had an effect on that. I'd love to hear you opine on that.
Yeah. I mean, gosh, on what?
Well, on the idea that countries used to be much closer together economically, and that separation has grown, and that part of that, that you can watch the beginnings of that or the genesis of that with the rule of law and the pushback on the king. At least that was my read of what I read that you had written.
No, I think that's right. I mean, if you're going to talk about the emergence of, you know, we talked a little bit about the dynamics of extractive and inclusive institutions and how, you know, Venice could become inclusive and then go extractive. But of course, the big picture in the world in the last 250 years is the other direction. You know, societies like, you know, my own country, England, that were pretty extractive, and we give lots of examples, became much more inclusive, you know, and that's our explanation for why the Industrial Revolution happens when it does and where it does, you know, that especially in the 17th century, there was a lot of contestation over the organization of society politically and economically. And out of that, much more inclusive political institutions emerged, much more accountability, much more representation, a much more powerful central state with a modern fiscal system and bureaucracy. And that led to enormous inclusion in the economic sphere. So it opened up the economic sphere. So it's a sort of transition from extractive to inclusive. So you could say there that, you know, the message is very optimistic in the sense that, you know, 250 years ago, the differences in the, you know, levels of income per capita between England and Nigeria, you know, might have been 4 or 5, you know, not 50 or 70. So that enormous gap is something that's actually only appeared in the past 250 years. And it's appeared because some societies, you know, Western Europe, North America, made this transition towards much more inclusive economic institutions from extractive institutions. And, you know, of course, how that happened in Britain is different from the US, you know, but in the US, we sort of tell the story comparing the US to Latin America. And why is it that, so, you know, these colonies in apparently very similar circumstances with very similar ideas and technologies, the US becomes far more inclusive and compared to Latin America, and how that explains the differences in prosperity and inequality between North America and South America. So that's a, you know, the thing about the language of inclusive and extractive institutions it's very useful for talking about these differences. But of course, if I look at, you know, how a society goes from becoming extractive to inclusive, there's lots of different ways that could happen. You know, the way that happened in the United States, you know, in 17th century Virginia is different from the way that happened in, you know, 17th century England, for example. You know, there's different factors and different mechanisms at play, you know, but yeah, these differences. So that's a very optimistic message, you know, like all of this, you know, incredible technology and prosperity in the world. That's something that we've all created, humans have created in the last 250 years by making society more inclusive. You know, it's just that that hasn't spread everywhere in the world, you know, and that's the problem of development. Yeah.
Now, your argument that I really enjoyed on that is that so many economists today believe, you know, that's all because of geography or it's because of natural resources. You gave a couple of comparisons that I thought were beautiful. One was Nogales, which is, I'm in Arizona, so that's one that hits close to home. And the other one was the Koreas. Maybe if you talk a little bit about those too.
Yeah, we use what an economist would call natural experiments to try to sort of illustrate our theme of institutions and sort of say, you know, there's, of course, you could think of other explanations, you know, like Africa is poor because it's in the tropics, or there's, you know, there's malaria, whatever it is, you know, but, you know, or Africans have some culture which is kind of incompatible with capitalism or whatever. But what we try to show using these natural experiments is that, oh, come on, it's got to be institutions. You know, if you think about this Korean peninsula, you know, it's a sort of fantastic thing. If you look at the Korean peninsula at night, you see that North Korea is completely dark, you know, and South Korea is just a blaze of light, okay? And that's indicative of enormous differences in prosperity and living standards and opportunities. And why, how could that be? You know, it's all Korea. You know, it's the Korean peninsula. The geography is very similar. It's, they're all Koreans. It's culturally similar, deep kind of historic, all the same. It's obvious what generates that difference. Everybody knows the answer. That's why that example is so nice. It's the way the Koreans organize the economy. You know, in the North, you have this socialist model that killed incentives, killed opportunities, killed markets. In the South, you had something completely different. And why do you have that? You know, why is it that North Korea is like that? Is that they, because they have bad economists in North Korea? No, they have a dictatorship. That's why it's like that. Okay. So I think that basically that illustrates the entire theme of the book. You know, we could have just written a chapter on Korea and left it at that, but the publisher said, no, you've got to kind of elaborate a little bit.
Your publisher was right. I enjoyed the rest of it.
Yeah, yeah. And we also use this example of Nogales, you know, Nogales, United States, Nogales, Mexico. Kind of, you know, there's a fence down the middle. It's culturally very similar, historically very similar, but there's enormous differences in living standards, in security, in people's opportunities. You know, why is it that people want to go from the South to the North and not the other way around? That's everything to do with the institutions also in that case. So we use a series of those examples to kind of, you know, just sort of get across in a simple way, oh yeah, they've got to be right. These guys. Before we get into the details, we got to sell you on the big story with those examples.
All right, so I'm going to change course just a little bit. Colonialism, how does that fit into this story? Was it helpful, harmful? What's your view of that?
Well, I think there's a lot of variation in colonialism. The United States was a colony. You know, Australia and New Zealand were colonies. So I think, you know, historians make this big distinction between settler colonies and non-settler colonies. I think what you see is that, you know, European colonies, which could occupy spaces where there were very few indigenous people, and in particular, where you couldn't create a viable society by exploiting indigenous people, they developed, you know, very different type of institutions, much more participatory, you know, much more inclusive than places like, you know, Mexico or Peru, where, you know, or large parts of Africa, where you could, you know, you could basically build a colonial society by exploiting indigenous people. So I think, you know, colonialism, you know, it, you know, if you look at former colonies, you know, it's you know, you have the entire world distribution of income within former colonies. So it's not colonial. I mean, it's not, of course, you know, it's not colonialism per se, but colonialism did very different things in different contexts. Of course, you know, in the United States, colonialism expropriated indigenous people and stole their land. And, you know, so I'm not advocating colonialism at all. I don't think colonialism was a good thing anywhere, actually. But I'm just saying, in terms of prosperity, it has very different consequences, depending on the context, you know. So we again, we use that as a way of saying, oh, this is not about culture. It's not about, you know, Anglo-Saxons, you know, in North America, or Spaniards, you know, or, you know, Latins in South America. We don't think that's the issue at all. It's really, and that's, you know, that's what the scientific evidence shows. This is really to do with the conditions in the colonies and the kind of types of societies that emerged. You know, we use the early history of Virginia, and we contrast that with the early history of Buenos Aires and Argentina to kind of illustrate how these different types of societies emerged, with much more inclusive in North America, much more extractive in Latin America, with you know, with these long historical consequences that we've been discussing today.
Yeah, it's a you know, it's fascinating, but I think it still fits into the narrative of the book, which is when 20% of the people are extracting the goods from 80% of the people, it's going to be a problem, whether it's government that's doing it or whether it's being done because there's no government whatsoever and someone's taking advantage of them. So when you look back on that history and you go and you talk to people who are in Latin American countries, what's the message that you give to them? I know that has to be sometimes difficult just because they'll see it as being somewhat ethnocentric, but what's the message that you give to them in terms of what they need to do to help improve their economies?
Well, I don't have one of the benefits of this, you know, the terminology inclusive and extractive is useful because it's very flexible, you know, like, you know, what we have one chapter where we say, you know, why nations fail to get today. And we look at North Korea, Zimbabwe, you know, Argentina, whatever, you know, Uzbekistan, places which are extremely different, you know, culturally, historically, institutionally. And what do these places have in common? They're all poor and they all have extractive institutions. But, you know, when it comes to actually improving or changing something, then all the details become very important. All the details of, you know, what, all the details of the differences between the institutions in Uzbekistan and Zimbabwe become very important. So that's, you know, I think if you want to actually engage in such a way as to make constructive suggestions about how to make society more inclusive, then you need to have that kind of institutional knowledge, and you need to have a mastery of the institutional differences and the political context, you know. So I mean, I think that, you know, the simple thing I tell people is, you know, you need to make your society more inclusive. I think you go to any Latin American country, it's very easy to identify extractive institutions everywhere and point them out to people. But actually changing that, you know, that's a very different thing. You know, that's a political issue. You have to understand the politics, and you have to understand, you know, how to build a coalition for a more inclusive society. So then, you know, you can look at history and try to understand, you know, how extractive societies like England, how did they build more inclusive institutions, you know? And, you know, there's even examples in the, or at least some examples in the region. You know, Chile is a relatively successful example. You could say Barbados is a very interesting example of building much more inclusive societies. So, but I think, you know, unfortunately, there's a long shadow of history in Latin America. You don't see, you know, now the Chileans at the moment, you know, they just rejected this new constitution. They're kind of agonizing about how to organize their society and try to reconcile these different interests. And
where Pinochet's strength may have helped in that, to help bring apart inclusive policies. Fascinating enough, because he was considered to be, and probably was, somebody who was very much an authoritarian. I find that to be a fascinating dichotomy.
Yeah, but, you know, my view about Chile is, I think if you go back, you know, if you go back to the 19th century, Chile looks completely different to everywhere else in Latin America. If you go back to the colonial period, you know, when I teach about this, I always say, you know, Chile looks much more like like the United States and anywhere else in Latin America, there were indigenous people, but they were way off in the south, you know, beyond the frontier, in fact, you know, like in the US, they were beyond the frontier. So the Chile never developed these kind of extractive institutions, you know, that we've been talking about in colonial Latin America. You see much more participation, political participation in the colonial period. The 19th century, they have the best state, they build the most railway, they have the most effective military, you know, they steal the Bolivian's coast. There's a controversial issue for you in Bolivia, at least. I think it's actually it's much deeper than that. Like, I don't give President Pinochet much credit, actually. I think, you know, I think it's a much more historical thing. Chile always looks different going all the way back. And I think, you know, now I think there's a big problem with this constitution written by the military, but of course they can't decide what to do, you know. So but that's okay. It takes time. You're not going to get that right straight away, I think. And I think, you know, I've been.
Do you think that constitution's beneficial for them long term? Is it more inclusive?
I think it's just not legitimate. That's the problem. You know, okay. Whether particular parts of it are kind of good for the economy or not, I think that's not the issue here. I think it's much more kind of visceral and symbolic about the kind of getting over the society, you know, that was a very traumatic period. I mean, my wife has done a lot of research in Chile, and she did a dissertation in Chile. So I spent quite a lot of time there, and it's a very, very traumatic period, you know, and they're still recovering from that, the Chileans. And after the transition, there was a lot of like, let's not talk about it, you know, because if we talk about it, something terrible is going to happen. So they kind of repressed it for a long time, and now it's all sort of coming out, you know. And I think that's probably pretty healthy. I mean, British people would never do that, you know. It's not a British thing, yeah. You know, repress everything in Britain, you know. But the Latins, you know. I think it's pretty healthy, and I think something good can come out of it. And so I'm not, you know, and we, you know, we could argue about different bits and pieces of it, you know, about whether we thought this was a good idea or not. But I think that's not the big question. I'm pretty convinced that the Chileans will come up with something which will make stuff work. You know, I think Chile works very well generally.
It does seem like there's an arc. I mean, I didn't see this in your book, but I would think that the arc of the United States going through the suffrage movement, the civil rights movement, the equal rights movements, the human rights movement, all of those tended to be looking for a greater inclusiveness. It was more people demanding a seat at the table. And of course, that starts to spill over into economic issues as well, I would guess. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, you know, the two chapters where we talk about these dynamics, you know, where we talk about the dynamics of inclusive institutions, we talk about the virtuous circle, you know. But I think actually we do a better job in Narrow Corridor of talking about this, you know, this Red Queen effect, you know, which is about why would this dynamic have the property that you just identified, which is it sort of driving you in a more inclusive direction, you know, what would it be, you know. And I think that's what we were trying to capture, albeit imperfectly. There's something about the process that pushes you in a more inclusive direction. Yeah, I think that's a very nice observation you made there. And that's something we've been trying to capture, but it's not obvious, you know. It can go into reverse, and you know, and I think there's some hope to believe that that's the path Chile is on, you know. And I
all
think
right.
Yeah.
So here's a question I have to ask this. So this book became an international sensation. Everybody around the world was reading it. It was literally a common touch point in people that I was talking to overseas. Did you guys know that up front that it was going to be that big, that it was going to take off the way that it did?
No, not at all. In fact, you know, we wrote a previous book. We wrote a lot of scientific papers together. We wrote a previous book, which is full of hundreds of pages of mathematics, you know, and which sold 10,000 copies, you know, amazing, which is like amazing. So I remember when we wrote Why Nations Fail, we thought like, well, if this sells 20,000 copies, we'll be like really, really happy, you know? So I think we have a lot of, you know, I'm very good friends with Jared Diamond. I co-edited a book with Jared. I organized many conferences with him. He's just such an incredible person and intellectual. And I've seen so many people who've just read his stuff and just makes them think about the world. It gets them excited. And I always think, gosh, you know, like, okay, I teach, I have PhD students and I teach and I like that, you know, but if you can reach people the way he reached people, wouldn't that be amazing? So we thought we'd have a go at it, but we expected to fail miserably, I have to tell you.
Wow, that's amazing. And yeah. you just did what your passion told you to do, which was to write something that you believed in, and it turned into being a great success.
Yeah, well, I think you have to take risks in life, don't you? I mean, in academia, you have to take risks. You know, like I don't know how many ideas, you know, we've had where we've told them to people and they, like other academics, and they just like start laughing hysterically. You know, our most cited paper that we wrote, you know, Professor Acemoglu and I, our most cited paper, it's like one of the most cited papers in economics. We explained the idea once at the weekend at MIT when we were working on it to a very distinguished MIT economist who burst into laughing. You know, he thought it was the most ridiculous thing he'd heard in his life. You know, so I think like we could have just said, oh, okay, forget that. You know, but you have to believe in yourself. You know, my mother used to say, you know, if you don't believe in yourself, who's going to believe in you? You know, you just got to believe in yourself and just like suck it up and go for it.
You have to be fearless sometimes. So is there a new book coming out that we should be looking forward to?
We're not coming out. We're talking about it. I gave a talk at Harvard in the spring, which might be, we're talking about it. We have a lot of work to do though. Yeah, we have a lot of work to do.
What would the concept be on, if you could share that with us?
I could share it with you. You know, the previous book, the first book we wrote, and a lot of research we've done is about democracy and the origins of democracy and when and how does democracy emerge and when is it stable? And then, you know, we've been talking about inclusion and so, you know, at some fundamental level, like where, you know, how do humans think about that? You know, how do humans think about equality and, you know, where does that come from? Like, do we care about equality intrinsically? And if so, why? And where does that come from? Because we also like hierarchy. You know, I'm English. You know, we love the Queen and, you know, we love status, and economists all work for the Nobel Prize. What's that about? It's not about the money. It's just pure status. You know, so humans are sort of have these contradictory impulses. You know, on the one hand, we sort of seem to care about equality, and not just, you know, because of the economic benefits or whatever. Just we get annoyed at inequity or injustice. But we also tolerate and rationalize hierarchy. So how do you think about that? So we've been reading a lot of kind of much more historical work about, you know, the emergence of human society and transition from primates to early human society. What do we know about that? And just kind of thinking about historical examples. But, you know, we're very far from writing anything vaguely sensible.
That sounds exciting. Fukuyama wrote just a small section in his book, Identity, about the whole concept of how this individualism, Martin Luther took that to a new level by putting it into spiritual terms. And then Jean Rousseau took that and made it a secular process. But he really, I mean, I bet he didn't spend 6 paragraphs talking about an idea that I was hoping there'd be a whole book about. When you do that, I'd love to read it.
Okay.
Well, good. James, thank you so much. I can't tell you how much we appreciate you being on our show. I also can't tell you how much I appreciate you being in the world. Doing these two pieces of work, I think they really have been, they've been global altering, and they've certainly helped me in my thinking. I just want to thank you for being on our show here at The Optimistic American.
My pleasure. It's been a lot of fun.
All right. Thank you very much. Thanks for joining The Optimistic American Show. Now help us grow by subscribing to our channel. If you enjoyed the episode, please leave a like and a comment. There is so much more that we have planned. We can't wait for you to embark upon this journey with us.